It's season two of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. This is the second of three episodes based on our interview with Columbus State University archivist Tom Converse.
This segment of the interview has been edited for time and content.
Tell us something about your experience of going through all of the materials. Like, were there surprises, or, you know, you were already saying something about what you did during lockdown, but I'm sort of curious about what it was like when you first started going through the materials.
Well, when I first started going through it, of course, I had read Carson McCullough's novels. I had read Flannery O'Connor and the other sort of Southern Gothic writers, if you will. I know that's a broad term. So I knew something about her. And of course, I lived in Columbus, so I knew the area. But I didn't know that much about her personal life until I started going into it. And I said to somebody, it was like watching a mashup of a soap opera and a Greek tragedy play out in front of my eyes. It really goes from pathos to bathos and back all the time. I felt like a voyeur, and then I just couldn't tear my eyes away from it. And of course, as an archivist, you know, our goal is not to know everything that's in a collection. Our goal really is like a librarian. Librarians don't read every book, every word in every book. They read enough to know how to catalog it. So as an archivist, my main points are dates and names, and I try to capture those and get going and not bogged down in the reading. But I must confess, I read the letters between McCullers and listened to with the Margaret Sullivan thing between Mercer and Floria Lasky and Robert Lance, which was a fascinating circle, if you will, there. And these little marginal notes, like Mary Mercer, during the settlement of the estate, was having tremendous struggles with Floria Lasky, the lawyer, to try to get the estate settled. And Mercer's accountant and advisor was a man named Mr. Sale. And she was saying, oh, you know, Robbie says I should do this or that. And she was taking dictation or notes from a telephone conversation that she was having with Mr. Sale on the back of a letter about the settlement of the estate. And she said, Sale says, quote, these are not your friends. Even though they had been friendly, Robbie Lance and Floria Lasky and Mary Mercer and Carson McCullers, you know, Lance saw Carson as a source of income and had to be handled in a certain way. Floria Lasky saw her as a source of income, but yet had to be handled in a certain way. Mercer, I think both Robbie Lance and Floria saw as potentially quite problematic in terms of their relationship with Carson McCullers, but they had to deal with her in a certain way. And to watch these, in a way, was like watching scorpions in a bottle. They were always very polite up until deep into the settlement of the estate. And then Floria Lasky, the lawyer, and Mary Mercer stopped speaking. And they did not speak again until Floria Lasky came to Columbus, Georgia to participate in the unveiling of the historical marker there in front of the house. And after that, there was some rapport that went on. But it was a very fraught relationship.
Yeah.
It was a very fraught relationship.
No, there's no question about that. And there's also, you know, I've come to understand that a lot of the other people who were friends of Carson, like Mariel Bancou, not friends of Mary Mercer. And, you know, I don't know all of the history of that or what caused it, but there was a lot of bad blood.
Some of it was jealousy, I think, and fear of exposure. Like Mary Tucker and Mary Mercer had a very interesting relationship. They talked quite openly about, I think, Carson's attraction to Mary Tucker, her piano teacher. And Margaret Sullivan corresponded with Mary Tucker, and there was a lot of backing and forthing and avoiding the subject of whether or not there was ever any move made on either part, whether it was Tucker or Carson, but certainly it was in the air. Mary Mercer was, I think, very afraid of being exposed, if you will, for the depth of her feelings for Carson. And that's why I think she and Virginia Carr did not communicate, why she was horrified when Mary Tucker sold her collection of letters to Duke University, where they are now. Oh, Mary Mercer was furious and fearful. So those are some of the things that struck me. That Lillian Smith correspondence, I found, was unexpected and quite fascinating as well. You know, she was dying of breast cancer, and lived on a mountain outside Atlanta where she ran a girls' summer camp and also was crusading for civil rights and women's rights. And it was burned out by the KKK at one point. And the night that Carson was there and the she told her about that. If you don't mind, I'll read a paragraph.
Yeah, no, that'd be great. Letter. Sure. Mm-hmm.
This is a letter that, as an archivist, I always go back to documents. This is a letter that Lillian Smith wrote to Margaret Sullivan. And Margaret Sullivan had written to her and said, can you tell me everything about Carson McCullers? And Lillian Smith wrote back a rocket saying, how dare you pry into my affairs with my friends? You know, I don't know you. What is this? How dare you? How dare you? And Margaret Sullivan, instead of slinking away with her tail between her legs, wrote her back a 4 or 5 page letter and said, how right you are to have chastised me for intruding in this relationship. But let me tell you why I'm interested. And she told her that she had was writing her PhD on Carson. She found her works and her personality fascinating. At the time, she had not yet met Carson McCullers. And Lillian Smith told her in this letter that she had to meet Carson. She had to know her. She says, and I'm just going to read an excerpt. Also, her letters are covered with marginalia, and her letters are at the University of Georgia. And I don't know that any of these marginalia reached the archives at the University of Georgia. I'd love to ask, I intend to do it, and I forget to do it, for a copy of this letter, just to see, is it just the typed part, or did she leave the carbon in when she made all these notes? I'm not going to read those. But Lillian Smith, on March 4th, 1965, replied to Margaret Sullivan's second letter, and it's a fairly long letter, fairly long paragraph. She says, I'll tell you briefly the facts about Reeves' death. Such a nice guy, as I think I mentioned to you. He died in Paris by his own hand after a heavy drinking period. While he was having these difficulties with his old enemy, alcoholism, Carson decided to fly back to the States. She left hurriedly, bringing almost no clothes with her. As she once said to me, I tend to leave, to run, go somewhere else when things press too hard. She came down for a visit with me and had planned to stay for a week or two. She was also writing a piece for Holiday, or was about to do so. She had not written anything at the time of her visit. She came in one afternoon. That evening, as we sat talking, we had not seen each other in 2 or 3 years, and there was much to catch up on. She had been in France some of that time. I had been living on Brooklyn Heights, then had had a cancer operation and was finishing the journey. I had just finished it, and trying to recover from the surgery at the time of her visit. I just see him sitting around this big living room overlooking a mountain. Well, we were talking hard and fast, catching up, laughing over the strange, bizarre things that had happened to both of us, almost in tears over other things. And the phone rang. I answered it. It was New York and was her sister, Margarita. She told me immediately of Reeves' death by suicide. I replied in a quiet, casual tone so Carson would not guess anything was amiss. She asked, when will you tell her? I answered in almost a careless tone, in the morning, and we hung up. Since I get New York calls almost every day, and Carson knows it, she paid not the slightest attention. We continued our talk. We talked about her books, my books, our feelings about things, love, lust, death, perversity, hate, insecurities, et cetera, et cetera. About 11 o'clock, I suggested she must be tired and should go to bed. She went to my old bedroom in what we call the little house, and then Lillian Smith's partner, Paula Snelling, came by to see if I felt all right after a rather strenuous evening. I told her about Reeves, and we both felt she would tell Carson since I was weak at that time because of the surgery. And then she goes on to talk about how Carson, when she found out about it, was devastated, naturally, and drank a fifth of whiskey and held it magnificently, she said. And then they put her on a bus to go to Augusta, where she was going to stay with the psychiatrist who had written the book All About Eve, and was going to spend some time with there then. And she said, I should have given her a little whiskey to take along to help her stave off the shakes, but somehow I forgot to. Paula did tell the bus driver to take good care of her, that she had had a terrible shock, and see that she got safely to Augusta, which she said he would. And so she left for Augusta. But but I can just see that whole scene. It was just so cinematic in that.
Well, no, it is. And in fact, I don't know if you know this, Tom, but a playwright has made a play of that very thing that you just
read. No, I didn't know that.
And has sent me, I don't know if it has been produced. I think it's been workshopped, but because it is a fascinating story, something that I think I'd not really considered all that much until just now. And you're reading that. Imagine that bus ride that Carson took. That must have been just awful, you know.
And to me, it illustrates perfectly the combination of absolute disregard for any sort of obstacle. I mean, here she was, hungover, heartbroken, getting on a bus full of strangers outside Atlanta and going to Augusta with no luggage, no clothes, probably no money to speak of, and yet so vulnerable, so fragile. I'm sure that everybody on that bus knew that she was somebody with a burden, and they helped her bear it. I mean, I see it as an opportunity for people to do good that could so easily have gone south, and her taking it and expecting it and being appreciative of it. That would be a fascinating thing, both from the part of the bus driver and the part of the other passengers on the bus. But she would wander through New York, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, drunk as a skunk, according to the book, The February House. And there were so many opportunities for her to be mugged, to be killed, to be heartbroken, to be insulted, to be embarrassed. And she just did it in her condition, mental and physical. I admire her for that.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but there was a documentary made about Lillian Smith in 1963. There's a new documentary that was made just, it was right before we went into lockdown, because the Columbus Museum did a screening and they had me on a panel with the filmmakers to talk about, you know, the connection between Lillian Smith and Carson McCullers. But there was a documentary made for television, Miss Smith of Georgia, it was called, about Lillian Smith. And at one point, they interview Carson. And it's a very brief clip that they have. It's just like, I don't know, a minute, maybe two. And they interview her in her house in Nyack. And they actually do an exterior shot first. So you see the house in the winter. Yeah. And then the interview, and I just noticed this one of the recent times that I looked at that, because the center has a copy of it. She's sitting in the Marilyn Monroe chair, what I call the Marilyn Monroe chair. That's become part of my tour, because we have that, you know, here at the Smith McCullers house. And I show people the photograph, and the photograph of Carson and Isaac Dennison and Marilyn Monroe sitting in front of the fireplace there at the house. And I say, and you see this chair right there?
That's the
chair that Marilyn Monroe is sitting in. And I just noticed that the last time I looked at that documentary, when they're interviewing Carson, she's so weak. It's really sad. And that was 1963. That was 4 years before she died. You could just tell that her health was really bad. She was very frail. But I went, oh, wow, she's sitting in the Marilyn Monroe chair right now when they're interviewing her. So, well, anyway, that's all fascinating stuff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Carson McCullers Center's weekly We of Me. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more at mccullerscenter.org or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. This podcast was brought to you by Columbus State University's Carson McCullers Center for Writers and Musicians and by Columbus State University's recording studio. The music you heard during the intro and outro was written by Lilia Uge in honor of Carson McCullers' 100th birthday on February 19th, 2017. I'm Nick Williams, technical director for these podcasts, and I hope you have a great day. Tom Converse's reading of the Lillian Smith letter to Margaret Sullivan is from the Margaret S. Sullivan Papers in the Columbus State University Archives. The music you heard during the reading was Allemande from Suite No. 5 in C minor by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed live in Legacy Hall by Dr. Katrin Meidel on October 11th, 2020.